dedicated. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we have the rare treat of a visit with Nicholas Eftimiades. He is a longtime intelligence professional, having worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, even the State Department, now retired from all of that and serving as an assistant teaching professor in the Homeland Security Program of the School of Public Affairs at Penn State. He is also a senior research fellow of King's College. I want to make clear that the views he expresses in the course of our program are his own, and we're very pleased to have him with us to so express himself. Nick, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's great to be here.
Well, you have spent much of your professional career focused on Chinese intelligence, and I'm very interested, as we've been discussing what the Chinese are up to and the threats in particular that are now emerging from that quarter, to get your sense of specifically what Chinese intelligence operations appear to be involving in our own country at the moment. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the Chinese intelligence services, and actually China employs what I term, what I like to define as a whole of society approach to intelligence. Now, this is sort of key because the United States does not, and the United States is ill prepared to contend with that type of collection posture that that comes from China. So as an example, it's not just China's intelligence services, which are primarily the Ministry of State Security and the People's Liberation Army Military Intelligence Department. Those are the most active foreign intelligence services for China. However, they have use of and do exploit thousands of state-owned enterprises, thousands of commercial businesses, and thousands of Chinese scholars and students abroad. So it is a whole-of-society approach led from a central point, the CCP, which defines the collection objectives. And we see this, you know, we see this very publicly, actually.
I just wanted to drill down on that bit about students. You say thousands. There are, by some estimates, something on the order of 300,000 Chinese students in the United States at the moment. Would you say that the numbers of those that are either willingly or perhaps unwillingly serving as collectors for Chinese intelligence are really only a very small fraction of that number?
Oh, absolutely. And we should make it, they're not just collectors of Chinese intelligence. They're collectors for the Chinese system as a whole, the CCP as a whole. And that's a distinction that really needs to be understood. It's not like the intelligence services are in charge of all this collection. This is an adjustment that that our system has a tough time understanding, right? So you have 363,000 Chinese scholars and students in the United States. The FBI will tell you that it has about 1,000 cases of economic espionage against China going. 56 field offices, 1,000 cases. I think it's probably pretty high because that's 20 per field office, and it's really not very likely. But even if it is 1,000 cases, well, if 363,000 scholars and students, plus all the businesses, you know, that the state-owned enterprises that are operating and engaging in espionage. So you're talking about, we have active under investigation, less than 25% of 1% of those numbers. So the issue is one of scale. I mean, if just 1 or 2% of people are involved, I think 1 or 2% of any population is bad. So if 1 or 2% of population is involved, that's, you know, 7, 8, 9,000 active, you know, people working on collecting technology.
Right. And that sounds low to me, especially given the priority that the Chinese government clearly is assigning to such collection and the techniques that they have at their disposal, among them, you know, inducements like pressure on family members back in China to, you know, persuade, shall we say, if not coerce, individuals in this country to do their bidding. But I guess your point is, even if it's just a quarter of 1%, and we only have 1,000 active cases going, then we're woefully under addressing this problem.
Right, exactly, which is why I say it's a whole of society approach. We have to respond with we have to give a whole of society response. This can't be something that we expect the FBI to do. It's just not within the capabilities and you know, I mean, look at the thousands of cases we're talking about. It's just not possible.
Can I draw you out on one larger question here, which is the adequacy of our counterintelligence efforts more generally, Nick? Is this something that we are, if you were to extrapolate from this specific case and the statistics you've just given us, does that kind of characterize the shortfall in our addressing not only this problem, of course, but the Russians and who knows, North Korean influence operations, Iranian and others as well?
Yeah, we're the Foreign Agents Registration Act dates back to 1938 anti-Nazi propaganda. And it's woefully inadequate for dealing with foreign influence. Cyber wasn't invented in those days. Internet wasn't available. So there are a lot of inadequacies in the current legal structure and our ability to deal with not only foreign influence, but the type of training, if you will, and the focus of our counterintelligence agencies. I brief a lot in different areas. And my perspective in talking to the U.S. government is, you know, you're going to cover your secrets very well. When there's an external threat, you circle the wagons and cover your secrets. And of course, that's, you know, agency bureaucratic behavior. But you're going to die with your secrets because the rest of America is a very soft target. And they're the ones that are getting clobbered. It's the defense industrial base. It's the technology. It's the trade secrets. All these, the strategic intelligence posture has shifted globally. Those things are far more important than they were 20 years ago. And our system has still not adjusted. That's the problem.
Well, I think generally speaking, our society hasn't adjusted to the fact that we are at war in these various ways. And that's where, as you say, the breakdown starts with this lack of a whole of society approach. Nick, let me just turn quickly and lastly to a story that caught my eye, and I'm anxious to get your sense of what on earth is going on. Specifically, the stories both in Irvine, California, and I believe in Australia, in which individuals seemingly of Chinese extraction are dressing up in the uniform of the People's Armed Police of China and driving around in cars that have their insignia on the side. What on earth is that about?
Right. Well, that's really interesting. And if you understand the Chinese, it makes perfect sense. So there are two options here. Number one is, you know, people in Australia and I believe the police have said it's multiple cases in Irvine, California, just unilaterally decided to spend the money and buying Audis and dressing them up as Chinese. I think they're trying to fist units, right? Part of the Ministry of Public Security, People's Armed Police. I believe they were their counterterrorism units. So they either decided to do that one day on a lark, not very likely, or that they had a purpose behind it. And in this case, that fits in very much with the Chinese government's pattern of behavior of trying to influence or coerce Chinese abroad. And, you know, they don't want support for Hong Kong. They don't want support, you know, going anywhere outside of the CCP. So this is China's Communist Party's way of sending a message to Chinese, not only citizens, but ethnic Chinese abroad. Hey, you have families in China. We know this. We will find you. We're watching.
It's in your face, big time. And not only in the face of the people of Chinese extraction, perhaps living here, but in the face of the United States government and its authorities as well, is it not?
Absolutely. How arrogant to threaten people who aren't even Chinese nationals, you know, who are U.S. citizens, who are the same ones who called into the police to complain about it, this intimidation, but to actually threaten them on American territory. It's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable arrogance, but it's very, very typical for China's Communist Party. I suspect these guys at the end of the day are going to be arrested for them for, you know, charged with FARA violations.
Well, I hope, among other things, impersonating police officers and so on. Nick, thank you for your long service to our country, for sharing your insights with us. I hope you'll come back to us again.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's a delight to have with us, as we do each week, a dear friend and valued comrade in arms. He goes by the byline Spengler in the Asian Times, but most of us know him rather better as David Goldman. He is the author, among other things, of How Civilizations Die, and it's a treat to have him with us on a regular basis. David, thank you. Welcome back.
Frank, it's an honor and privilege. Thank you.
You are one of the most astute observers of what's going on in China, David, particularly from your perch at Asia Times, but you're also a maven in the financial sector, and I want to talk with you about a couple of aspects of what we've seen going on this week, starting with the celebration, if we call it that, of the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the People's Republic of China. We had a major address by Xi Jinping on the occasion, and of course a military parade. I'd be very interested in your take on both.
Well, my friend Steve Bryan has been writing in Asia Times about the implications of the drones which the Chinese displayed on the parade. It was a real show of power, a goose-stepping, precision military exercise, which showed a lot of really scary hardware, including missiles that presumably can destroy American ships, and a whole set of new weapons, particularly
and
stealth
cities,
drones.
Among other things, in the United States as well, I'm afraid.
Absolutely. China is now saying we're a major power in some respects on par with the United States. We certainly are the dominant power in the South China Sea and anywhere a few hundred miles from our coasts. And a lot of military commentators have in the past year said the Chinese have done a lot of things we really didn't take seriously and haven't been ready for. For example, hypervelocity cruise missiles against which presently we have virtually no defense. And against which the Defense Department is spending very little money on R&D. So I think they have taken us by surprise in certain respects. I think people at defense were asleep at the switch, and they are rubbing it in and gloating about it. That ought to get us mad. But there we are.
David, how about Xi's speech against the backdrop of that arsenal on display?
And she is effectively saying the Chinese communist dynasty is unshakable and highly successful, and there's nothing to do about us, and we will be in power indefinitely. Now, no Chinese dynasty lasts very long by American standards. Hardly any of them last as long as the United States of America. But for the moment, she is cracking down and consolidating power. I don't personally believe there's a whole lot we can do about that in the short term. We need to develop a long-term strategy to surpass and show the weaknesses of the communist system relative to the innovation-based Western system. Unfortunately, you know, we haven't done a very good job at being ourselves in the last 15 years, so the Chinese have, relatively speaking, moved ahead of us.
David, let me talk to you quickly about Hong Kong. I heard an interview this morning with a billionaire based there by the name of Jimmy Lai, who I suspect you know. He spoke rather courageously, I think it's fair to say, about why the people of Hong Kong are resisting the increasingly coercive pressures of the Chinese government. Specifically, he was interviewed in the context of this pronouncement that the protesters will no longer be allowed to wear masks, either to protect their identities or protect themselves against tear gas and the like. What did you make of this pronouncement by the chief executive, and where do things go from here, do you think?
Well, now you have a very well-organized and quite effective group of protesters. This morning, they set a department store on fire. They've set a number of mass transit stations on fire. They appear to have eluded police. So, police are not in evidence at a number of sites where they've taken some pretty tough action. It's quite a dangerous situation. A lot of the Chinese hardliners I know are saying, what do we need Hong Kong for at all? They're never going to give it up. They'll send the PLA in. But we can simply shut down Hong Kong's functions. It'll cease to be a financial center. We'll cease to raise capital through it. We'll cease to do business through it. We'll move everything 20 kilometers onshore to Shenzhen, which is a city of nearly well over 20 million people, and just let Hong Kong wither on the vine, at which point people who don't like it will move to Taiwan or the United States or wherever they can get jobs. That's one outcome. I don't think an outcome is going to be that the Chinese Communist Party says, okay, Hong Kong, you can be whatever you want. You can ignore us, be independent. They simply won't do that. That's a matter of face and control. So I see those are the two possible outcomes.
Do you anticipate that there will be a mass infusion of People's Liberation Army forces in there to bring Taiwan to heel, even if they're essentially stripping it of its financial capabilities?
In an extreme situation, there's no question but that Beijing will do that. It's also obvious Beijing does not want to do that. They want to try to run a war of attrition, which wears down the protesters over time, and hope the thing will eventually go away. I don't see what else they can do but make one two choices, each of which is pretty bad for them. Let the thing go on, hope it goes away, or if they send in the PLA, they look like brutal thugs and before the world, and it certainly hurts them too. Hong Kong is a unique situation. I don't think you're going to see response to Hong Kong on the mainland. It's a very different kind of place. Hong Kong's a British city, always has been. Mainland China is very tightly locked down.
Yeah. Do you, very quickly, David, do you think that the effort to migrate financial power from Hong Kong to the mainland will be impeded by the absence of the rule of law on the mainland? That has been one of the distinctions between the two.
It would be an enormous blow to China because Hong Kong has a convertible currency. It's the one place where you can take Chinese currency and exchange it for Hong Kong dollars, which can then be exchanged for any currency in the world. It has an efficient and functioning capital market. It has British courts. Many Chinese multinationals have moved their operations to Hong Kong precisely because it's much easier for them to write contracts under British law as opposed to Chinese law, which is basically an oxymoron. Mainland law is whatever the Communist Party feels like any morning, and so it's been for thousands of years.
You'll be following it closely at Agent Times, of course, David Goldman, and so will we with your help. Thank you for joining us today. Come back to us again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It is a delight to say, joined by a friend and colleague of many years, His name is Douglas J. Fife. He served with distinction as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the George W. Bush administration, one of a number of other positions that he has held in government service. These days, he is a senior fellow and the director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute. Doug Fife, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Good to talk to you.
Well, there's a lot to talk about and not a lot of time, but let me just plunge into it. I'm interested in your thoughts about sort of tectonic shifts that are taking place in the Middle East region, broadly defined. Maybe we could start with the attack on Saudi Arabia, one of now several that have taken place. But I'm thinking specifically of the one involving cruise missiles reportedly launched from Iran itself, or certainly with the connivance of the Iranian regime. What did you make of that attack, and what would you argue would be the appropriate response to it by the United States and its friends and allies?
I think that the context of the attack is that the Trump administration came in and substantially changed U.S. policy toward Iran. The Obama administration had viewed Iran, amazingly enough, as a potential strategic partner of the United States, and entered into the nuclear agreement with Iran as a way of just getting the nuclear issue pushed to the side so that they could pursue their big strategic initiative to try to embrace Iran. And this was based on, I think, a rather crazy reading of history that suggested that the reason that the Iranians were hostile to us was America's fault and that we could solve that. OK, so we had the Trump administration came in and said that it rejects that Obama policy on Iran. And it withdrew the United States from the nuclear deal and started imposing sanctions on Iran. And while I think that the Trump administration has done some things good and some things bad in the international relations field, one thing that I really think that the administration deserves praise for was having an insight that almost nobody had of how effective unilateral U.S. sanctions could be. And we imposed unilateral sanctions on Iran that have had a severe effect on the Iranian economy. And for example, their oil exports went from approximately 3 million barrels a day to about 500,000 barrels a day. That's an enormous cut in Iranian oil exports. So we've squeezed the Iranians very, very hard. And now the Iranians are flailing in response. And I think it's important to understand that the Iranians had an extremely aggressive national security strategy that they were pursuing with the extra money that they got as a result of the nuclear deal. But now they're being squeezed financially. And so what they're looking to do is to flail and challenge the peace and security of the whole region in the hope that other countries in the world will be so upset with their failing that they will put pressure on the United States to relieve the economic sanctions in Iran. And so I think that's the context of what's happening. And that's why the Iranians seem to be behind this attack on Saudi Arabia. And I think what's important to recognize is that the flailing by Iran does not represent a failure or a defeat for the United States. It represents the effectiveness of the economic pressure that we're putting on Iran, and it suggests that we should maintain that pressure and try to get serious changes in Iranian policy and maybe even persuade the Iranian people that they need a new government.
Well, I have the feeling this has come to their attention already. The question is, can we help them accomplish it? And I certainly hope we can and will. Doug, because we do have a limited amount of time, I want to turn to something else. In the Wall Street Journal, you wrote this past week, I believe, about the U.S.-Israel defense treaty that has been bruited a bit by both President Trump and Bibi Netanyahu, specifically in the run-up to the recent rather unsatisfactory election in Israel. You described some concerns that you have about that idea. Could you just lay those out for us, especially at a moment when I think an awful lot of people think we need to be enhancing Israel's security at a very dangerous moment? Iran, as you say, is lashing out. They've made no secret of their desire to destroy Israel. You, I know, share that idea that we need to stand with Israel closely, but not with a defense treaty. Walk us through that, please.
Right. Well, I mean, I speak as somebody who puts a lot of value in the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and I'm a strong supporter of Israel. But I think that a defense treaty, if it is set up to be a substantively important document like the NATO treaty, would have two major bad effects. And that's the reason that for decades, nobody in Israel or the United States who is a strong supporter of the relationship has actually favored a treaty of this kind. And that is, we don't want a treaty that will interfere with Israel's freedom of action. And we don't want a treaty that will put the United States in the position of having essentially to own everything that the Israelis do militarily. Because the Israelis need flexibility. They do things that we don't necessarily approve of. And it's been highly advantageous for the United States to let the Israelis have freedom of action. And when they take risky actions that pay off, then we get the benefit of them. And when they take risky actions that we don't want to associate with, we can say they did them on their own. And that's been a very good arrangement for Israel and for the United States. So there are some ideas to make a defense treaty that would not be substantively important. And it would say something simply that, you know, that the countries are friends and will, coordinate and cooperate and discuss together their common concerns. And if it's, you know, if somebody wants to create a framework agreement that's simply a statement of friendship that gives like an overarching structure to the numerous executive agreements that we have with Israel, I think that would be not terribly important, but not objectionable. What I think would be objectionable would be to try to make a treaty that, as I said, you know, violates this longstanding principle that we should not limit Israel's freedom of action, and we should not put the United States in a position where we have to be associated with everything they do. We certainly wouldn't want to be in a position where we have to commit U.S. troops to Israel's defense, because Israel has never wanted that, has never needed that, and I don't think it would be good for the relationship.
I think this is a really important point. We want to strengthen the relationship, not impinge upon it, and I think your arguments about particularly the freedom of action of Israel are persuasive, Doug, and I appreciate you laying those out so clearly in the Wall Street Journal. You've also addressed in a long piece that you published recently at the Hudson Institute, another actor, shall we say, in the Middle East, increasingly, it would seem, at our expense, namely Russia. Talk a little bit about Russia's strategy for the Eastern Mediterranean, as you've called it, Doug, and its implications for both the region and our vital interests there.
Again, the context is important. The United States, during the Obama years, decided not to intervene in Syria in this civil war. And there were serious arguments on both sides of the whether to intervene or not debate. But the fact is, and nobody disagrees with this, our decision not to intervene created a vacuum. And I mean, even if you think we did the right thing, it had the effect of creating a vacuum that the Russians have filled. And the Russians became the dominant military actor in Syria. And in alliance with the Iranians, who also invested very heavily in the Syrian civil war in favor of Assad, they ensured that Assad won the Syrian civil war. The Russians have been rewarded with an major air base, a major naval base. Both bases have been improved. And the Russians are now a serious major military power in the Middle East as a result. And they demonstrated lots of capabilities during the civil war, and they've become a major actor. They have a lot of interests that they're pursuing. They have so much capability, and they're aligned with the Iranian Assad Hezbollah axis, that they have influence both with the Shiites in the Middle East and with the Shiites' enemies in the Middle East, the Saudis, the Israelis, and others. And the Russians have strong interests in high energy prices, and they're using their influence in the Middle East to influence Saudi Arabia in all of its policies, including in particular its oil pricing policies. And they have a strategic capability that they could possibly turn into an area denial strategy in the event of a conflict with the United States. So it's a very significant development for military reasons, for energy and economic reasons, and for political reasons in the Middle East.
Doug, I think you've touched on so many points that really warrant our close attention. Doug, come back to us again soon. Thank you for your time today. God bless you. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon. Next up, Michaela Dodge joins us. We'll talk with her about deterrence, the adequacy of what we have and what we need. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by one of my favorite people. Her name is Dr. Michaela Dodge. She is these days a research scholar at the National Institute for Public Policy, an absolutely terrific organization. Welcome back, Michaela Dodge. So good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction. It's great to be back.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the state of deterrence. In recent programming, we've talked with others, Michaela, about the missiles on display in the Chinese celebration of the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic and the nuclear exchange that was simulated, or I should say nuclear attack that was simulated in a joint Russian-Chinese exercise known as Center. What is your sense of the magnitude of the threat we're facing at the moment and the adequacy of the deterrent that we have in place to contend with it?
My assessment is that nuclear deterrence is under stress and under increasing stress. And part of the reason why it is on stress is that we haven't done any significant nuclear weapons modernization since the end of the Cold War. And so while Russia and China are showing off their new missiles and new warheads and improving their nuclear weapons capabilities, we have not done much of anything. And the plans to modernize our nuclear forces and nuclear infrastructure have been lagging behind.
They're modest to boot, and it would seem in some jeopardy of not being properly funded or executed in a timely fashion. But even if they are, as you say, Michaela Dodge, they are day late and considerably short on dollars. Let me ask you this. Specifically, we have seen evidence in this Chinese parade and in a lot of reporting by Mark Schneider at the National Institute for Public Policy, your colleague over there, among others, about the emergence in the Russian and Chinese nuclear arsenals of hypersonic missiles. What are the implications of such missiles for, again, well, our strategic vulnerability as well as our deterrence posture?
So I would say on hypersonic missiles that these missiles that both Russia and China can already target us with their nuclear weapons. And chances are that they sort of tailored their nuclear warheads to be able to achieve different kinds of objectives with different levels of collateral damage. That being said, there is a difference between attacking with nuclear weapons and attacking with conventional weapons. But I think because these developments are fairly new, I think it remains to be seen whether they are very much groundbreaking or whether what will be their strategic impact. Now, of course, the problem with hypersonic weapons is that they are very much a difficult nut to crack for our missile defense, even though our missile defense efforts continue to be so limited that, again, they cannot address Russian and the Chinese ballistic missile threat for now.
Oh, and I think this is really the crux of the question is we've had comments by Mike Griffin, the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, that have expressed very real concerns about the inadequacy of our missile defenses specifically against these hypersonic missiles. Vladimir Putin has boasted that we can't defend against this emerging capability in his arsenal. The same would apply to the Chinese, presumably, too. This raises, I know, for people like us who are deeply convinced of the need for us to have effective missile defenses, especially in light of what you've said about the shortcomings and possible inadequacy, let's be clear, of our nuclear deterrent, that we may find ourselves unable to address this emerging threat in the hypersonic category. As you see it, Michaela Dodge, what is it we need to be doing in space in particular to ensure that we have a chance of defending our people and our country against this emerging threat?
I am sort of in a camp of first things first. So I think we really, really are way overdue in terms of deploying space-based sensor layer that would make our existing missile defense systems better and more effective. Of course, in space, I regretted that we have not been developing space-based interceptors. We continue to be unsuccessful on this front because our ground-based systems are very limited, or either by range or by quantity or both. And the only way how we can build a comprehensive layered missile defense system is, pursue the ground-based stuff that we're currently doing and sea-based stuff that we're currently doing. But the space-based component is really, really critical part of that effort if we are going to think about scales like the Russian and the Chinese ballistic missile or missile threat, which we absolutely should.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Michaela, let me ask you, you also have specialized over the years on matters of arms control. And I think since we last talked, the United States has formally withdrawn from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Treaty, which frees us up to begin at last countering some of the developments that both the Russians and most especially the Chinese have been making in missiles of this category. I believe it's 500 to 5,500 kilometers or so. What is your recommendation, Michaela, with respect to enhancing our deterrence against missiles of those particular ranges in both Europe and Asia?
I think first and foremost is to make sure that our political alliances are in a shape that can support competition with Russia and China, kind of regardless of whether they have INF range missiles or not. I do think it's worthwhile to have intermediate range missiles. If nothing, it is something that forces the Chinese and the Russian planners to take them into account, even if they're not deployed. Because we know that intentions can change, situations can change. And, you know, people who say that, oh, there is no way these missiles would be deployed today. Well, maybe not today, but the security situation is not static and trends are not in our favor. And so, again, you know, first and foremost, making sure that our alliances are in a shape that can support efforts potentially like that, and two, having capabilities to counter the Russian and the Chinese ballistic missile developments. And, you know, maybe part of the response, too, is not just tit for tat, you know, missile on missile comparison. Again, part of the response likely is missile defense, too.
Yeah, I agree. Let me just ask you quickly, in closing, Michaela Dodge, that for your response to a letter that I believe 17 Democratic senators wrote in August, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, one of the frontrunners for the Democratic presidential nomination now, urging that the United States not deploy or even fund any new INF-type missiles until, quote, diplomatic and strategic planning steps are taken, unquote, and that we not allow the deployment of a lower-yield warhead for the Trident D5 submarine-launched ballistic missile. What are your thoughts on the advisability of those recommendations, Michaela?
I think those recommendations are misguided. We are creating too little, too late response to very aggressive changes and developments in the Russian and the Chinese nuclear force postures. What we're doing with the low-yield warhead, which it's not a new weapon, it's not a new capability, and it does not threaten survivability of our submarines. What we are doing is making sure that the Russians do not exploit the gap that they tell us they see in our nuclear posture to their advantage.
Would you characterize that gap very quickly?
The gap in the lower levels of nuclear escalatory ladder. And so what the Russians are saying is the United States doesn't have capability to respond to our sort of preemptive low-yield nuclear weapons use. And so what we want to do potentially is to deploy nuclear weapons early in the conflict to terminate the conflict in terms favorable to us. So things like low-yield nuclear warhead actually strengthens deterrence. There is a whole another argument to be made about the target types, the air-launched cruise missile and the long-range standoff missile might or may not be able to get. There is part of it that has to do with survivability of delivery platforms and sort of the kind of force packages you have to fly to get to those targets, but that gets a little more complicated.
Thank you. Michaela Dodge, come back to us again very soon.